Did you work on any of her campaigns which sent her to Albany or to Washington prior to 72?
No. I was just a supporter from a distance, an admirer, supporter. I was at that time, as a matter of fact, I was in college at that time still. I was away from the city. But Shirley, Ms. Chisholm was a real, you might say, stellar giant in our lives, especially political science majors. We saw that as the the clarion call that there was a time changing and that we would have an opportunity as young people coming out of school to actually participate in electoral politics. Ms. Chisholm being a woman as well as from the Central Brooklyn community, she gave us all of the most important ingredients that caused for challenge. And at that time, coming out of the 60s into the 70s, we saw ourselves challenging the system in order to change it, but not so much challenging it from a radical challenge, but challenging it utilizing electoral politics. And Ms. Chisholm was the standard bearer for this moment in our history.
When you worked on her campaigns, what tasks did you do when you say you were a campaign? Did you leaflet stuff, envelopes? What did you do?
All of the above. My main task was I did photographs. I'm a photographer. My main task was always following Ms. Chisholm at events, sort of memorializing the things that she was doing through still photography. Wherever she went, whenever she was out campaigning, we followed her and took pictures. And these pictures would then later be used either in literature or whatever. We had documentation of her moving around Central Brooklyn.
And this is 76 on?
Yeah.
Okay, 19. Who else, how large was her staff? Who else was there? This is the Brooklyn staff.
Yeah, this is the Brooklyn office. My sister worked in that office, Marita Green. Victor Robles. And then the giant in that office that was behind the whole scene, the kind of glue that kept us all together, was the great Mack D. Holder, Wesley Mack D. Holder.
When did she have her break with Mack Holder?
I would assume after that campaign, my memory serves me correct. But that campaign was Mack Holder's, I guess that might have been the Sis Swan Swan Dance, that campaign. Because that was a major, major, major one. As I said again, the challenge was that these were both, there was a daughter of Brooklyn and a son of Brooklyn, both running. And both had legitimacy within the Central Brooklyn community. Both had a strong following. And they were not that far apart in terms of their sentiments to Brooklyn, the people they served. So it came down to a very, very strong campaign on the part of Ms. Chisholm in order to present herself as being the better of the two candidates that we would have to choose.
How did she raise money for her campaigns?
She raised it the old-fashioned way. She had folks who did their luncheons or coffee sessions or a lot of the first time I got a view of people doing things right in their own living room. Small donors, just making small donations. People that believed in what Ms. Chisholm stood for. Small donations. It wasn't like she had a major sources. It was just the little people in Brooklyn Central that believed in her and gave her their support.
And what was she like with her constituents? Describe how often she met with them, how she met with them, what she did.
Every time Ms. Chisholm was in Brooklyn, she was somewhere. If she wasn't, I remember her liking to go into the housing complexes. The Marcy houses, the Tompkins houses. She went a lot into the churches. But she sort of nurtured her constituents. Everyone came in her to see her in her office. It was very special. Her office was right here in Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration on Fulton Street. And you walk downstairs, Ms. Chisholm was stopped by people who would just walk up to her with a small issue or a major issue. And Ms. Chisholm would take time out of whatever she was doing to focus in and listen. She had a very sensitive, compassionate attitude towards her constituents. And I think that's what made her a cut above special, because it's almost like she took each of her constituents and nurtured them in her arms and gave them the kind of tender, loving care that they deserve as human beings. As well, that they are the ones who elected her and sent her to office. So her job was to keep them happy, and she never lost sight of that.
Do you know what community groups she was more active with or worked with in Central Brooklyn?
I know she worked very closely with the various Democratic clubs. The agents themselves right now, I would say, if my memory serves me, a lot of the tenants associations, a lot of the block associations, whenever she would have a key meeting and say a gathering of some kinds, would be mainly the blocks and what have you, the very grassroots agency, not the more organized power bases, but the more grassroots day-to-day folks, PTAs. She was very big on education. So it would be a thing where teachers and others in that venue would come up and be supportive of what Ms. Chisholm stood for. But at the same time, they would be sort of expecting the kind of reciprocation from Ms. Chisholm, which they got.
And what do you know about her role in the formation of Medgar Evers College and her relationship with Medgar Evers over?
That is a great question, because the reason why I'm saying that is because we've been exploring that more and more lately. I went over the listing and I didn't see her signing off on it, but maybe because of her being in Congress, she did not sign off on that initially. But
you mean she was in Washington as opposed to Albany?
Yeah.
Because Albany had to. Okay.
Yeah. At that point in time, she was in, because remember, Medgar came about in the early 70s, and Ms. Chisholm had already went to Congress.
Right.
I think she went to Congress in 1970. Was her
68.
First. 68 was her first. And 70, she was being in her second term in Congress.
Right.
But Model Cities was one of her, if not her, she helped to birth Model Cities. Meaning in Albany, she worked with the Model Cities piece, and then when she went to Washington, she maintained that. And the things that came out of Model Cities, the inner city schools here, meaning Medgar Evers College and other institutions that grew out of the Model Cities, the Jobs for Youth, the LRU, and all those programs were Ms. Chisholm's pet programs that she maintained. When she went down to Washington, it gave us an opportunity to have someone down there on the floor of the Congress that was lobbying to keep these programs going because of their importance in inner cities, not only inner cities of Brooklyn, but inner cities throughout the nation.
And she also was very proud of her sponsorship of SEEK.
Yeah. SEEK was that brainchild, which was, again, her connectedness with education. Gave her this, it was like having a teacher in Congress at all times, having a professor in Congress whose major input would always be around education. She always pushed education agendas, which was a good piece, especially at that particular time in our history.
How would you define her as a legislator in what you know? History. And you came back to Brooklyn. When did you come back to Brooklyn again?
I came back to Brooklyn on and off from about 75, 76. a legislator in Washington, I mean, we knew her bills got through. We knew she had such a schedule. I remember always her back and forth. Even during the campaign period, Ms. Chisholm was back and forth. Sometimes she would go down in the morning and come back up in the evening to be on the floor to vote for a bill. She would always have that wherewithal that, even though she was holding down Brooklyn, which she did very well, she had that responsibility in Washington. And she always found herself managing both worlds. Sometimes I think she would even go down by car and back up and, or by plane. But she was back and forth always. So I know she did her piece on the floor. And being the kind of person she was, I know she would probably have had a tremendous attitude about not missing votes, because she was that kind of precision kind of individual.
Did she ever talk to you about the campaign 1972?
Not directly, but you know, a lot of the things that she mentioned about herself after 72, after that campaign for president, grew out of her, sort of took her onto another plane in how she ran her congressional seat. That she's put herself now in a position where she was like that fountain of hope, or fountain of faith, or fountain of strength for the other legislatures. We always talk about the Chisholm Cubs that began to come. So that campaign of 1972, as I said before, was sort of the lightning bolt for the others, whether the people who came from other areas, whether it was a Barbara Jordan and others. The impetus of her presidential run, even though we would think of the congressional seats that we were able to garner, the assembly seats or the council seats, may have not been as, of course, not as major as a presidential run, but what that presidential movement did for the Chisholm Cubs who came after her and for the community as a whole was took us to a whole nother level politically. And how Ms. Chisholm would always almost like, we almost like saw her the best president that we never had. You know, she would be, and she acted like she hadn't been in that glory moment, and you could sense that her glory moment was the fact that she stepped out and ran that campaign for president. And it was a legitimate campaign in the sense that she had all intentions to do what had to be done to win that election. As we know, she fell short and things happened that didn't happen. The votes that she had expected, the support she had expected, didn't happen. But I think that was a major victory for Ms. Chisholm and for the Chisholm Cubs that came behind.
When she would speak, did she... I mean, she was really known for child care and education. Mm-hmm. Those were two key things. But she was very well known for speaking on issues like abortion, of course, civil rights. And did she speak about those issues in this community? And also your thoughts or what you remember if she ever spoke about, you know, the black nationalism that emerged.
Well, you know, Ms. Chisholm's whole thing was she. Let's take the last one first. We began to see Ms. Chisholm as the not so much as the antithesis to the Black Nationalist movement at that time, but Ms. Chisholm offered us a option to that whole movement. Ms. Chisholm's option was that we could attain the status in society through electoral politics, which at that time, if you really think about it, we had not that many high visible examples of electoral politics as being a method of us getting to that promised land of civil rights. And it had been after Dr. King had left and Malcolm had left, Medgar, all these leaders had been assassinated, whether the strong nationalists, whether the civil rights. So Ms. Chisholm offered us that option that it wasn't all bleak, that we had had the leadership they had left, that there was still a lot of living of us left to do in terms of movement, and that was through electoral politics. Now, the other side of it, she was the example that we sort of needed without her actually stepping out and raising the clenched fist. Ms. Chisholm's clenched fist was that she backed down from no discussion. She backed down. I remember when Jimmy Carter was running for president, and he made way here to Brooklyn, and we met, as a matter of fact, she met him right at Brooklyn College. There was a big gathering at the college that day, but Ms. Chisholm wasn't in the audience. Ms. Chisholm was the person who introduced Brooklyn to Jimmy Carter. And I remember how, because I was right there with her at the time, and I remember how President Carter sort of said, well, this is the ring that I come to kiss in Brooklyn. I have to kiss this ring of the great political leader of Brooklyn. And just the way her grace and the way she carried herself, it made us all, even if it wasn't the supranationalists, it made us all proud to know here was a woman from our very midst, from our very community, lived right on President Street, who carried the torch for us and carried the torch so well. And she didn't carry it with rhetoric, she carried it with action. That on Boston on Bath speech was sort of her everyday living. That campaign, I remember, was a lot of twisting and turning and pulling, and Ms. Chisholm always stayed her course. She never got caught into the fray when the arguments and the discussions started. She never got caught into that. She would just stay on her course and allow them to come up to her level and not her go down to the other's level.
Did you know Conrad, her husband?
Yes. I knew him. Not as well as her, because he was a very behind-the-scenes kind of person,
and,
but I knew him.
And her sisters?
Not directly, again, just in passing, either, you know, in the office or at times, whether it be at events or what have you. But Conrad, I met him a few times, and as a matter of fact, the day Ms. Chisholm finally was moving from off of President Street, I remember it was a Saturday and we helped her. You know, we were there to help her move the things and pack them in the vans and stuff. And,
excuse me, was she moving out of Brooklyn then?
I think.
To a different address.
To a different address in Brooklyn. I know she was moving off of President Street. And then it's been a while now. I don't think she was moving out of Brooklyn at that time. Because she went to Buffalo after she retired from Congress. She might have moved somewhere else in Brooklyn, but I know she moved off of President Street, that I remember.
And all you campaign workers helped her move?
Yeah, we helped her move. You know, it was like a thing where Ms. Chisholm, sort of like a motherly or a big sister kind of feeling, beyond just, she was this congresswoman, you know, Ms. Chisholm was, she kind of made you feel personable towards her. She was a personable individual. Even the last time I got to see her, I thought it was actually in the early 90s. She gave me an award, her daycare center, Shirley Chisholm Childhood. I'm trying to remember the name of the group now, but it was part of her. And she came down to the event at Restoration in the auditorium, and I remember being on behind stage, and it was just like that was maybe 15 years later, but we warmed right back up and started conversation, and, you know, it was like real personable as always. You know, she had been, you know, been out of politics now, and she'd been, you know, as a private citizen, but she still maintained her same exuberant spirit that she had at that time.
Can you just remember anything about, did she have hobbies, any sort of interesting personality traits, quirks?
Loved to dress. She dressed always meticulous. you noticed, her earrings were always there. She always dressed. So I guess fashion was probably her, one of her hobbies. But that I always remember, so meticulous. Her nails and her dress and everything was matching. Even at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, if we were going still to another event, that Miss Chisholm would always look like she just started the day. She was always committed to her work, so I don't know what she did on her downtime.
I heard she loved to dance.
You know who can tell you a lot about that? Bill. Bill Howard, because he was one of her dance partners. They would go out and he would always, in fact, Bill would always talk about how Miss Chisholm would always wait for him as her partner to dance. So make sure when you speak with him, you talk about her dancing.
What haven't I asked that you could help us with?
Well, if you look now, if you have to make Miss Chisholm contemporaneous. And in making Miss Chisholm contemporaneous, as we see what happens today in politics, at as we see this present election that we're involved in now, that both the candidates in the Democratic Party embodied what Miss Chisholm started out. You know, they're her. This is her her moment in history that she initiated. As Dr. King said, he would not get to the mountain. He'd only get to the mountaintop, but he wouldn't get to go into the promised land. And these folks having such a high level of visibility in Senators Clinton and Barack Obama, they're at the mountaintop now, and they could actually, I could say that almost went into the political promised land. Even whoever ends up in the White House next year, January, they have raised the level of a black and a female in both of those candidates are embodied Miss Chisholm. And her seriousness about her candidacy, I think I've seen the most serious of the candidates in this primary that I've ever seen over the course of time with the others who came before, women or black. So if we make her contemporaneous, I think that would be what I would like to bring into the general discussion, that the power of Miss Chisholm's movement back in 1970s, in the early 70s when she started this whole movement, is manifesting this afternoon. And in so doing, I think this is a, whether it was planned this way or not, but this testament to Miss Chisholm could not be more timely. Because for a long time, I think Miss Chisholm's impact had been forgotten.
I want to focus on that for a second. Why do you think that that's true? I'll give you an interesting story. Her largest collection of papers are at Rutgers. Camille and I went down to Rutgers. Mm-hmm. Do you know how many people have looked at her papers in the last 6 months? One person. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to know why you think. And even on BAI, Amy did a thing with Jesse Jackson and about Obama and Clinton's legacy, and he didn't mention Chisholm. I mean, he talked about the civil rights movement and his campaign and so forth and didn't mention her. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't think that the world realized the impact of the statement that Chisholm made. It hadn't been told. I can mention Chisholm in my own classes, and I see the response that I'll get from my students. What happened is the society played a part in that to sort of downplay the impact of Chisholm's political moment in the political limelight. Because it was just completely out of time, out of place. So that was a kind of ironic piece of memory to political memory that the society chose at that moment to brush aside. And what you saw beyond that was just the result of that brushing aside. We didn't have the luxury of technology at that time to really be able to spread Ms. Chisholm's message out there. The media that chose to cover her did it in a limited way. So therefore, what we see today is a result of a, whether I would say a conscious or an unconscious moment to kind of negate that. That didn't really happen. Let's move that out of the path of history. But now, 30 years, almost 40 years later, we are bringing it back to life again. And now we have the great moment in our own history of the technology. So what happens, what I would like to hear the two Democratic candidates that are running now, paying homage and credence to who was their Abraham, their political Abraham, you know, who was that individual who we all say is our, whether it's a black candidate or a white candidate, if it's a candidate that would not normally be out there, who would be their guru? And I think Ms. Chisholm would be that individual. So bringing her contemporaneous now, I think it's a good moment, and couldn't have been better timed than right now. And where students in the future now will be able to link what is happening now in terms of the political scene now to its genesis. And by so being able to do so, you're able to get the fullness of those young people who are going to be going after elected offices beyond today. They're going to be able to go back and study the run of Ms. Chisholm. Go back and study her ethics. Go back and study her commitment to what she stood for without having, imagine if Ms. Chisholm had the luxury of the technology that we have today back in the time when she ran, how she would have been able to bring this whole country, like you see what happens now. She would have been able to wake this whole country up, and we might have advanced ourselves politically by about 20 years, and we could have jump-started this thing to where we are today. But I think that's more important than anything else I'd like to see. That the next time you go down to Rutgers and look at her papers, that you've seen thousands and thousands of hits of people have come by to see what she was doing. And we should be able to get that same archives, some of that archives right here at Brooklyn College and Medgar Evers and the other Central Brooklyn institutions, where we could make this happen, where the students will know and scholars will know that, you know, we're people doing. I know someone was doing a dissertation the other day, and he came and interviewed me about Chisholm, which was very, you know, interesting. He was doing a dissertation on Brooklyn Central politics, and he came and we spoke about Chisholm. You know, so there was. It is coming alive, and as I said again, I have to commend the efforts on the part of, you know, you and this institution and what we're doing here at Medgar, that we're going to rekindle the flames and the spiritual flames that Chisholm had brought to the political arena, to say that, you know, her campaign was run with such grassroots. She had no major money. Even her congressional races didn't have major financing. That was one of the things that we always had to be scraping and moving and doing things, carpools and all kinds of little things to save money. We would volunteer at the polls, you know.